As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the England show on The Athletic. I'm joined today by The Athletic's George Culkin, Ollie Kay and Dan Bardell for a very special show. England face Scotland at Wembley on Friday night, but today we're going to go back 25 years to the last time the two nations faced each other in a major tournament, which was, of course, at Euro 96. Now, George, along with Alan Shearer, has written a brilliant article for The Athletic on the game, the whole tournament. There is an awful lot of emotion and plenty of memories in that article. And today we're going to hear from the players featured in it. So that's Paul Ince, Teddy Sheringham, Gary McAllister and Gazza. If you want to read it, then you go to theathletic.com/Englandpod and you can sign up for just £1 a month. So theathletic.com/Englandpod and you get The Athletic for just £1 a month. This is The England Show from The Athletic.
So welcome to Wembley for England against Scotland, the oldest international fixture of them all, first played away back in November 1872. That one finished 0-0. The hopes are that this one will have a few goals as well. And as is the custom in this 1996 European Championships, a handshake between the teams as a prelude to the battles that will come ahead in the next 90 minutes.
Before we hear from the players and Alan and discuss the tournament, let's just find out where we all were in the summer of 1996. I have a feeling that one person on this panel is going to make the other three of us feel really old. Let's start with George.
I was on holiday in Portugal for certainly the first couple of weeks of the tournament. So my memory is not the best anyway, but there was certainly a lot of beer. there was a beer influence to that loss of memory as well. So I was in Portugal in a bar or two watching it that way, which is a pretty great way of watching it actually.
Yeah, I think I'm going to be through a beer haze as well, really, because I'd finished my postgrad in broadcast journalism and was joining the BBC later on that year. So I kind of had a free summer just to watch all the football, and I was living in London at the time. So it was a magical summer, really. We'll come to Ollie last. This is where Dan, you tell us you were four and can't remember any of it or something, is it?
I mean, this is a rare moment where I actually get to feel young doing a podcast. So I was 10. So 10. I was more in a sunny delight haze rather than a beer haze. So I just remember being at my mum and dad's friends in a garden, and then we all watched the game. Then I was out in the garden trying to recreate Gazza's goal, but I wasn't a very good footballer, and I'm still not a very good footballer, so didn't do a very good job of that. But yeah, I was 10, and it was my first tournament experience, and it's never been bettered, really, to be honest.
No, that's what I was going to say. So it was your first one. You can't really remember. I mean, World Cup 94 was a bit anyhow, unless you're Irish, in which case, obviously, it was great. It was World Cup 94. But for And if you were eight in English, I would imagine World Cup 94 kind of passed you by a bit, did it?
Well, I did watch it because at the time, I was just, I think I'd just got my Villa season ticket. So I was just started going to Villa every week, and there was four Villa players, obviously, in that Ireland side. So I supported Ireland just because there was four Villa players in there, and England weren't in there. So I didn't really have a great understanding of why England weren't there. But I just went with Ireland. But yeah, Euro 96 was just something different, a complete different level and different class to what I'd seen before.
Was there a sticker book in Euro 96? Like, because for my first tournament, which was Spain 82, I still have the sticker book somewhere in my house, completed full. My favourite tournament ever, because it was my first one, which is similar for Euro 96 with you. But was there a sticker book?
I don't remember having a sticker book. I remember having, you know, the football men with the big heads.
I had
all the England ones of them and all the Villa ones. And actually, I'll tell a little story. It might not be that interesting at all. It might be a stupid story to tell. But when England got knocked out in the semi-final, I was in tears, crying. Obviously, a Villa player had missed the penalty as well. And my mum's quite busy around the house. Like, she never stops cleaning, never stops tidying up. And Southgate obviously missed the penalty. And it sounds like a complete lie, but it's genuinely true. I went upstairs to go to bed, and they all used to be on like a shelf. And Gareth Southgate had fell on the floor. So like, now all the football men were up on his shelf, and when I go upstairs, Gareth Southgate, the big head, was on the floor. And it honestly sounds made up, but I swear that is genuinely true.
It was a sign. It was a sign. Ollie, where were you? What were you doing?
Yeah, very very similar to you. I'd just turned 21. I just finished my university finals. I was in Birmingham at the time, and probably down the road from Dan. And it was it was. Again, like you, like George, a very hazy month for one reason or another. I mean, it was you know, I'd graduated. I had this vague idea that I wanted to do journalism, but I hadn't applied for any courses or anything like that. So I had this sort of massive gap in my life about what I was going to do next. And I think for that month, all such worries were put to one side as I just sort of. Had one very long boozy afternoon after another, watching England and practically anybody else.
Yeah, anybody else. Yeah, you just drank it all in, didn't we? So this is going to be Euro 96 through the eyes of three middle-aged men, maybe a dog and a much younger man, plus the players who played during this tournament. Because, George, you've done this piece with Alan Shearer. And for Alan, you know, we've talked about what this tournament means for us already in relation to where we were in our lives. Did you find with Alan and with the players that you spoke to that this is the tournament that still has a very special place in their hearts?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And for Alan, incredibly important because he'd gone almost 2 years before that tournament without scoring a goal for England. I mean, he was absolutely in his pomp at Blackburn. So he was scoring 34, 37 goals a season at Blackburn, but had that sort of really sort of traumatic spell for England not scoring. And, you know, he says in that piece that he feared that if he didn't score a goal pretty early, that it might be the end of his England career, which is pretty astonishing, really, when you sort of then look back on how good he was. But there's this sort of amazing narrative arc, if I can use that phrase, which I think probably goes back to 1990, which was probably the most important tournament in my living memory for England and for football in general in this country because of what it meant. But you had all those sort of little echoes at Euro 96. So it was the moment when football kind of exploded again in this country in 1990. And we had the disappointment of England going out, but it was Gazza again. It was Gazza again at Scotland. It was Stuart Pearce and redemption. It was Gareth Southgate taking on that sort of mantle of agony, but it was also at home, and it was also that sort of build through the tournament, that momentum and that feeling going sort of behind it. It was Germany again. There was the absolutely sort of brilliant performance against Holland. And then probably the sort of the big sort of moment was that Scotland game because of the pressure England found themselves in. And so, yeah, it was this magical summer, but it was this magical summer for the players as well. And, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about the pressure they were under before the tournament because of sort of off-pitch stuff that had gone on in the summer. It was a very different environment with the media. It was ferocious back then. It sort of all came together in that summer. And it's, you know, it's the best, I think it's the best England have played at a tournament that I can remember, certainly the Holland game. You know, when Shearer says, we took them on at Total Football and we hammered them.
We'll come on to that in a little while. But as George says, the relationship between the players and the media was ferocious, particularly before the tournament had even started, because there was the pre-tournament trip to Hong Kong. Here's Teddy Sheringham and Alan and Gazza with their recollections of that infamous night out and the reaction that followed it.
A guy come over and just fancy the dentist chair. I says, come on, we'll give it a go. So obviously, me being me, was I went for it. And obviously, and then the rest, I says, come on, you've got to do it. And then they did it. And then it just come to the time where obviously we're all having fun and then it just got carried away. And then I never thought anything of it. I just thought it was a great night and that. Just got carried away, too excited, I suppose, the person I am and that. But it wasn't until, obviously, when me family called us up and says, fucking hell, have you seen the... Well, excuse the language, but have you seen the papers? And obviously, I was a bit devastated. And then, obviously, then on the flight come back, I was thinking about it and I thought, oh, we're not getting in trouble.
I think all that what happened out there, it brought a nice unity. Venables had a lovely way of bringing the team together, then he had his whole squad together. Didn't really bother me, really. It was like a case of we was allowed out. All right, we went a little bit reckless on the night out, but it was our one night out 2 weeks before the start of a major competition. Ain't that big a deal, really, the way I see it. The press made a big deal, but, you know, Terry just said, let's come together and be that unified squad and, you know, let's get on with it. So
he sort of used it to his advantage, Terry, in terms of he didn't cause a big fuss. He accepted what it was and sort of treated us like he had to and got on with it and used it as an advantage to say, well, we probably owe him one to go into the tournament and do well.
What people don't realise, Al, is that, you know, everyone went back to the family. But what I did is I went to, it was so funny, I got in a taxi and I went all the way to Wales. And I stayed in a hotel and I went to this hotel and I said to the guy, listen, I've done something wrong. I says, I'm going to stay here for a couple of weeks before the Euro 96. And he went, I says, does any press turn up? And he went, no. He says, you Grant stayed, yeah? And no paparazzi's turned up. I went, okay. And then after about now, he went, you're not going to believe this. I said, I am. How many? He went, about 30. So I got on the boat, I rowed across the lock. I got the other side, and I stayed in a little hotel. Then I went to the health farm for about 5 days and just trained, trying to get myself well. And then, obviously, I seen the newspapers, like, kick Gazza out the Euro 96. So I was a bit worried then. You know, I was quite fortunate that Terry Venables was my manager. I taught him and he knew the sort of person I was, you know.
In the 90s, when I used to hear people talk, George, about what they did in the 60s, you know, and a glass of stout in the dressing room afterwards, I used to think, God, how ridiculous. Hasn't football moved on? And now I sit here in 2021 listening to that, an England's best player rowing across a lake to try and avoid the press, having been in a dentist chair in Hong Kong. And it's like another world. It's like, how on earth did that happen?
Well, he says on the plane that he was worried about the reaction back home, but actually on the plane was when even more mayhem took place. There's a great story in one of Gascoigne's autobiographies where he talks about Dennis Wise crawling into one of the overhead lockers just to get some sleep and to get away from Gazza. And an FA official comes up the stairs to tell them to keep the noise down and Gazza tells them to fuck off. I mean, it's very difficult to sort of turn back the clock and sort of understand that. But it was a different time. I don't think there was anything wrong with that idea of giving them a night out a couple of weeks before the start of the tournament. But obviously it got very, very messy. And it's then on the front pages of every paper. And football back then, certainly Gazza, were part of the circulation war that was happening. It was very similar in 1990 as well, when kind of Bobby Robson, he'd been at the sort of fulcrum of that battle, really sort of vicious circulation war. And it was a different time. And, you know, that was the pressure that they were all coming into in the tournament, where papers were having votes on whether Gazza should be kicked out of the squad. I should say also that not all of the memories from Gazza are reliable. I mean, I think that's something to say. I mean, I think I've seen other versions where he got to Wales, found the paparazzi waiting for him and immediately left. So, you know, the discovering the truth from some of this stuff, it was actually quite difficult.
It evidently helped them, didn't it, Ollie? Because they all talk about Venables as management of that of that situation and the reaction that followed.
I remember the sort of reaction to it in the build-up, and you know, players were being interviewed about it, and they were very much putting on a united front. I mean, it was clear that not all of the players had been as culpable as each other. It wasn't, you know, some players had, I think Gary Neville and Phil Neville had been tucked up in bed in Hong Kong while all this mayhem was going on. And I think I'm right in saying Tony Adams opted out of that night out because he didn't trust himself, because he knew he had a problem in terms of drink. I think that's correct. It wasn't a case where they were all sort of equally to blame, whether it was for the night out in Hong Kong or the damage done on the to the plane on the flight back, which was something else. There was this sort of sense from Venables and amongst all the players, we will all take collective responsibility for it. And that I think that was probably the first time I ever heard that phrase used in a sporting context, collective responsibility. And it did appear to, I mean, it was said at the time, and it's certainly been said in the reminiscences that they've all had over the years, that it really did bring them together, and it created that sort of siege mentality. You know, the media are out to get us, the public are out to get us, we need to pull together, we need to reward our manager who's sort of taking the flak on our behalf. And that kind of thing in the build-up to a tournament, I don't think the media coverage was helpful in any way, and yet it did somehow. It was sort of used as a sort of galvanizing, unifying force within the camp. So sometimes when, you know, when we look at the media coverage and when it is all negative, obviously sometimes it can really create those negative vibes in the camp. But it feels like on that occasion, it really did the opposite. It really unified them. Not that anybody in the media should be taking any credit for that.
No, absolutely. And it is difficult, isn't it, Dan, when you listen to it, to disagree with Teddy Sheringham. And George has mentioned it, that, you know, 2 weeks out from a tournament on an overseas trip, they are allowed a night out.
I mean, I thought it sounded quite reasonable. I mean, at the time, I would have probably been quite oblivious to it. Like, I would have just assumed they'd been to the dentist or something. I wouldn't have really understood what was going on. But I mean, I still think now players are on time off and they've got permission to do as they please. Let them live. They're human beings. But I just wonder how much Gareth Southgate, the manager, has taken away from that time, because obviously he would have been a big part of what was going on. I don't know whether he was on that night out, but you think of his strength as being man management, and Terry Venables seems his strength was the same, the man management. So I just wonder how much Southgate has taken away from a tough time like that.
Yeah, fascinating. I mean, everybody now remembers, I mean, sort of doing these interviews with Paul Ince and Teddy Sheringham and Alan, they all sort of saying the same thing about Gareth, that he was the kind of quiet one. I mean, and that none of them sort of really expected him to go on to become a manager, certainly not an England manager, because he was, you know, when you think back to the characters in that team and the kind of leaders in that team, whether it was Tony Adams or Shearer himself or Ince or Gascoigne. I mean, pretty sort of ferocious personalities, some of them. But of course, and definitely the Venables side of it is incredibly important. The players, I mean, I might, you know, I don't sort of know all those players, but they seem to a man to have absolutely loved Venables, not only because of the way he treated them, but very sort of tactically astute. But the way he handled that was perfect. It was pitch perfect. He didn't hang any of them out to dry. He sort of took responsibility for it, and they knew that they owed him. You know, they knew that they owed him. And, you know, there was another very clever bit of man management on that trip. I spoke a bit about Shearer at the start, but Venables pulled Shearer in China and said to him, look, you're not going to play every minute here, but you're my number nine for the first game against Switzerland. And so Shearer had that feeling as well. They loved him. He gave them freedom. You can argue he gave them too much freedom on that particular night. Should be pointed out, by the way, that Brian Robson was out, his number two was out there drinking with them. So it was a little bit difficult for them to get, you know, told off too much. But no, it definitely pulled them all together.
So let's move on to the tournament itself. And maybe the reality is perhaps a bit different to what some people remember. England weren't great in that opening game against Switzerland, a 1-1 draw at Wembley. And they were struggling against Scotland in the first half as well. So here's Paul Ince and Gary McAllister with their memories of the two games.
Going back to the Switzerland game, it wasn't a great game. You know, it wasn't a great game. And I mean, we had a great start, obviously, you saw it. And But we know, Al, from playing international football and playing in those international tournaments, that the first game is always tough. You know, the first one, you don't want to get beat. You can't afford to get beat. You know, yeah, we fancied ourselves against Switzerland, but, you know, you can't afford to drop 2-3 points in a group stage. And, you know, as much as it was disappointing, the 1-1 draw, we knew the Scotland game was going to be tough. We knew that was going to be tough. You know, we did. You know, we knew the Holland game was going to be tough. So it was quite a tough group when you think about it, Al. So when you don't get the 3 points against Switzerland, you think, fuck me, we got fucking Scotland, which is obviously...
I thought centrally, because we had the overload, we had more players in the middle of the park. You know, it was just Gaza and Insy, where we had Stuart McCall, Johnny Collins and myself. I thought we won the middle of the park. And mm-hmm. well, that the footballing-wise, we'd stopped you guys from playing. I wouldn't say that we were creating loads and loads of chances, but we felt as if we had good possession and we're getting into your back line a wee bit better than you were getting into our back line.
It was, wasn't it? It was laborious, Ollie, at the start for England.
You could lump the first game against Switzerland in with the first half against Scotland. It was poor, really. I mean, there was the early Shearer goal. I was against Switzerland. I was just looking back, and it confirmed what my sort of hazy memory told me, which was that obviously England hadn't qualified for the 1994 World Cup, so basically they hadn't had a competitive game for nearly 3 years. Graeme Taylor had been sacked, and Terry Venables had come in, and they had all these warm up matches, almost all of them at Wembley, where it was just nil-nils and 1-1s, and he was experimenting and sort of Christmas tree formation and three at the back and all kinds of different formations, and never really sort of, nothing ever really clicked, which is probably reflected in Alan's goal-scoring record at the time and the fact that, you know, the team was scoring very few goals. And then, obviously, great start against Switzerland, but by, I don't know, probably by the half hour mark, it was really sort of looking like a slog, and they, you know, they clung on and conceded a late penalty, which the Swiss scored, and it was 1-1. And the build up to that Scotland game was very kind of negative, really, in terms of, you know, there was a lot of criticism, there was a lot of skepticism about the team, about Venables, about how they were going to play. The first half was really poor. I was just looking back and seeing that Gareth Southgate played in midfield in front of a back three in that first half. And what really changed it, I know everybody remembers, I mean, Alan was saying in that piece that nobody remembers his opening goal. People only ever remember the Gaza goal that came next. But what really changed it, and what I think has been forgotten in the mist of time, is Jamie Redknapp came on in midfield at half time. And, you know, there was a switch there. England now had sort of three against three in central midfield. And that was the, I mean, Redknapp was only on for, I don't know, it was probably 30, 40 minutes or so. And then he got injured. But that sort of cameo from him was really the catalyst to the second half of improvement, because the first half was awful. They were clinging on, as Gary McAllister says, and Scotland were the better team. And it all changed with a overlapping run and cross from Gary Neville and the header from Shearer early in the second half.
But as Ollie mentioned, Dan, you know, England had come into this tournament on the back of no competitive games for 2 years because they qualified, not qualifying for the World Cup in 94. Actually, Euro 92 had been utterly miserable as well. It had been awful from an England perspective. So actually, ever since the high of Italia 90, England had been doing that. So they were needing a spark from somewhere as a country.
I watched the game back last night. As I say, my memories of it wouldn't be great at all, but I watched it last night and I was really surprised by it, because as a kid, just remembering how good I thought the tournament was, it surprised me watching the game back and seeing how slow and turgid England were in that first half. And I agree with what Gary McAllister was saying. I thought Scotland looked comfortable and arguably were the better side. But as Ollie's gone on to say, Jamie Redknapp coming on, I mean, I've got that team that played in the second half in front of me now, and I look at it, and it looks preposterous, really, because it's a 3-5-2 with no wing-backs, which is not really something that I remember having ever seen in my lifetime. So you've got Anderton and McManaman on the flanks with the midfield three and a back three behind them, Shearer and Sherring up front. And it was Gary Neville on the overlap from right centre-back, a bit like a Sheffield United centre-half of a couple of years ago, coming in and putting the cross in. And Alan Shearer says that no one remembers his goal, but for some reason, when I was a kid, I had like an irrational love of Gary Neville. So I was more buzzing about Gary Neville's cross for Alan Shearer than I was about Gazza's goal. So Alan can slate well because I remember that goal.
That's a very odd thing.
I know.
To admit,
I was an odd child, Mark. A very odd child.
The other thing with Alan, George, is, as you will be well aware, Alan remembers every single one of his goals and is then deeply offended when you don't remember every single one of his goals, which I don't. You with your Newcastle connections will remember every single one of them. But as I tell Alan regularly, I used to boo him for the majority of his career. So, you know, I try to forget most of his goals.
No, that's right. He describes that goal against Scotland as the sort of the big forgotten goal because everyone talks about Gazza. I mean, the other thing to mention about Scotland, I mean, so England had put themselves under pressure with that first game against Switzerland. Gazza had been substituted. He wasn't sure that he was even going to stay in the team and kind of had sought out Venables for reassurance the night before. And it's a different Scotland as well. It's not just a different England. It was a different Scotland back then. They'd missed out on 94, the same as England. But this was a Scotland team who were used to qualifying for major tournaments back then, who were kind of pretty regular. And sort of we say in the piece that it's impossible to sort of avoid those cliches, but this is a massive derby game. You know, that's the equivalent. And you know that it's going to be a physical battle. And I think England went out with that sense that the first thing that they had to do was match Scotland's physicality. And so they just didn't settle. They didn't settle in the game. And hearing that clip from Gary McAllister, he was actually responding to Alan saying to him, it was pretty even, wasn't it, in the first half? And he took exception to that. He didn't, you know, because his very clear memory was that Scotland actually were on top, and Ollie's absolutely spot on. It was that it was changing things at half time and putting that extra body into midfield that gave England a bit of space there, that gave, you know, that gave Gascoigne license to do his stuff because they'd really been struggling. And it was a match, it could have gone either way.
And by the way, just one final word on this. You know, if you are a bit younger and don't remember a lot of that of your 96 or the Scotland team, Ollie, That Scotland midfield of McAllister, McCall and Collins, that has a beautiful balance to it. I mean, that is a seriously good midfield.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people might remember Gary McAllister from the sort of back end of his career at Liverpool, but, you know, for years, you know, at Leicester and Leeds and Coventry, you know, McAllister was a very graceful, elegant midfielder. Yeah. John Collins, very elegant as well. And then Stuart McCall was a real feisty, I was going to say sort of typical feisty Scottish midfielder, but he's a Yorkshireman. You know, he was, you know, extremely feisty in the middle of the park and could play a bit as well. So it was a really good midfield, and England had gone sort of, you know, with Southgate and then with Ince and Gascoigne against them, and you know it wasn't working in that first half. Those Scotland midfielders were getting the upper hand as Gary McAllister says.
Let's deal with the. With how the game changed in the space of a few minutes. We'll come on to Gazza's iconic goal in just a moment, and we'll hear from Gazza on that. But first, here's Gary McAllister on his penalty miss and what went through his head when the ball moved.
Now, let's see whether McAllister's nerve will hold. A brilliant save! McAllister holds his head. Scotland denied an equalising goal.
Listen, the reason why I've never revisited the game is because it wasn't a very good day for me as far as you know, missing. It's now clear to everybody's eye. If I'd gone out after the game and said that the ball had moved, it would have been one of the almightiest excuses ever. But the ball did move. And I talk quite freely about it now. You know, and you know when you hit a penalty, and when you plant your left foot, when you're right-footed and you plant your lefty strike and you're right on the ball and it moves, I had a million things in a millisecond happen inside my brain.
So you were aware then when the ball moved, it was that split second before you hit it, you were aware of the ball moving, yeah.
You know the timing of it. I was literally about to release the shot and the ball sort of flipped over. So I was thinking, am I going to stop and run the risk of bumping into the ball? Or do I, you know, try to swipe above it? Or, you know, all these things. And I suppose the mechanism that just kicked in was, I'll just lash it. And I didn't smash penalties down the middle. Mm. I generally I went for a stop penalty. And if I seen the keeper go early, I would change it. But I was too far down my run-up to change, and I just lashed it. And obviously David makes a great save, and it goes up the left side of the pitch, and the rest is history.
The first thing I would say about that, Dan, is just to hear two penalty experts having a chat about the technique of a penalty is fascinating. But forget the context and everything else that happened. Just listening to them talk about how they take penalties is really interesting.
Yeah, the planted left foot as they came up is not really something that I've ever considered. I mean, I've actually missed a penalty at Villa Park in my lifetime in front of the whole end, which was one of the worst moments of my life. So I can relate totally to how Gary McAllister must have been feeling at the time. But I was watching the game last night, and I did see Gary McAllister play, and I did think that was it was an odd penalty for him to take, because you think of him with the finesse and side footing a penalty and placing it. So to lash it down the middle, what was an odd thing. But I've just got memories of a child it was obviously Yuri Geller, who seemed to be on TV a lot when I was a child. I've got a lot of memories of him being on GMTV and bending spoons and talking about weird things. But he tried to take the credit for it, didn't he? And said it was because of him, the power of his mind, that the ball had moved.
Sorry, are we questioning that?
It's a fact. I believe it's a fact.
You recognised that it was Yuri that did it.
I believe that's how I moved that ball. Mind power.
But Ollie, that actually highlights but McAllister's point there, that if he had come out and said, oh, the ball moved, he would, the English media in particular, would have ridiculed him.
Or they would have leapt onto the idea that Yuri Geller really did make the difference or whatever.
Yes, they would.
The positive energies that Yuri Geller had urged us all to channel. It was really weird, wasn't it? You know, I don't think it was spotted in, look, this is me trying to remember watching it in a pub 25 years ago, but I don't think it was spotted instantly that the ball had moved. Maybe Dan can confirm from the TV coverage that he watched, but yeah, it felt like it either became apparent sort of in the minutes afterwards and they went back and did a replay or at full time. But it did the ball did move, and you know, it probably, I mean, should that have been retaken? You could probably argue it should have been, because it was certainly unfortunate from Scotland's point of view. And I just remember thinking as well that England had sort of scored in the first game and then conceded a penalty later on. And it felt like that was exactly what was going to happen, the same thing again. And then they were going to go into this really tough game against Holland, the final group game. And I just remember thinking, as that penalty was about to take a go, you know, this goes in, England are probably going to get knocked out of the group, because it would mean a draw and a draw and then Holland to come.
It was still an astonishing save by David Seaman, by the way. I mean, it wasn't, and he'd already kind of pushed a shot from Gordon Dury onto the post. That would have made it 1-1. But I've watched back the sort of the penalty in freeze frame, trying to, you know, frame by frame to try and see the ball moving. But you actually just see how instantaneous his reactions are as well, Seaman's reactions are. And of course, he doesn't get the credit either, because everybody remembers the bit that sort of happens 30 seconds, a minute later.
Just before we come on to what happened the minute later, I mean, it came through there from McAllister. And did you find this in being present in these interviews, George, the pain actually that is still there in some ways, as McAllister said to Alan there, you know, he couldn't revisit that game for such a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm writing something sort of on penalty shootouts at the moment, trying to sort of make it a bit different. And I think that, you know, the thing that sort of surprised me is we all know the shootout narrative, we all know the shootout stories, we know Southgate, we know Pearce and Waddle and so on and so forth, but just how those moments live with people away from the sort of famous ones. I was on the call with Alan, sort of, I was in the background, and then what I would tend to do is I would kind of come on at the end and just ask stuff if I felt anything needed following up. And I kind of took my life in my hands and asked him about that again. And he sort of shut down. I mean, there was this great freedom of the two of these kind of great old pros chatting to each other. And he just said, there was a night 4 years ago when I didn't think about it. It's partially tongue in cheek, but it also wasn't. I think that's the thing. These moments live with you. So you can make the argument that, you know, this was his job. It was his life. And this was the biggest game. You know, it's England versus Scotland. It's at Wembley. It's a major tournament. If Scotland had won that game, they would have gone through. They'd already drawn against Holland in their first game. And so that big moment he associates, that, you know, the biggest moment he associates with failure. And I think those things are very, very difficult for people to get over, with absolutely good reason.
To the Gazza goal then, an iconic goal with an iconic celebration. Here's the man himself talking us through it.
Well, after the save, Dave saved it. After the save, I'm thinking, oh, brilliant, we've got a chance here. And then when I went to Teddy, and then he's given it to Dan, and I seen a gap, and I just thought, go for it. You know, take a runner with us. But for Darren to play that ball was perfect. You know, it was a great pass. So obviously, I've got into the box, and I went past the other centre-half, the Celtic centre-half. I went past him, and then I just had a quick glimpse, and I seen Colin coming. And I thought, I've got him. I flicked, obviously did the flick over him, and I just thought, just connect perfect with it. I didn't really have that much time to think, and I hit it, you know, and the feeling was phenomenal.
Oh, here's Gascoigne. Gascoigne, he can finish it here! Paul Gascoigne! 2-0! Would you believe it?
Still up, and I just said, look, guys, whoever scores, do the dentist chair, please. And obviously just get on back. But, you know, to actually see it and then actually get the goal. And I think the guys knew, because when I went on my back and I just pointed at the bottle, they looked at the bottle and they knew, they grabbed it, you know. I think it was Teddy Sheridan that sprayed it on. But it was just a feeling, the fact that, you know, you think 2 weeks before that, I was getting all that grief. I was hiding in wheels in a hotel, keeping away from everyone, was nervous, you know, and, you know, see the headlines, kick him out, he shouldn't be allowed in the Euro 96. So to get that goal, that raised me confidence. You know, that goal, the celebration, that's one thing no one could ever take from me. And I'm quite proud of that, you know. There's things in my life I would like to change, but obviously I can't now, but the only thing is I'm improve it, you know. And I try my best. I'm not brilliant at it, but I do try.
One of the things, George, that I've always thought about that was, in the heat of the moment, having scored an unbelievable goal in a game against Scotland in a major tournament, to remember to do your planned celebration, I find quite remarkable. Because, you know, the intensity and the pressure and everything else to score that kind of goal and yet still remember, quick, get the bottle, do the celebration, I find remarkable.
Yeah, but then I suppose it had been such a big part of the build-up, hadn't it? I mean, it was what everybody was talking about. It was this, you know, he was on the front page of tabloids in the dentist chair or celebrating and things like that. And again, there's a bit of confusion about whose idea it actually was. Gazza said to understandably takes credit for that, but it seems, you know, there's been a bit of debate about who came up with it and when and where, whether it was on the bus, whether it was in the dressing room or whatever. But Paul, there's a great quote from Paul Ince, where he said he was some other part of the pitch. And he's thinking, what the fuck? You know, he's actually said, what the fuck? Just fuck it. Oh, Dennis Chair, okay, fine. Yeah, just get on with it. Can we win this game, please? But it was just that perfect moment, wasn't it? I mean, the goal itself was extraordinary. The flick itself is, you know, is a work of art, as indeed was the build-up to it. But, the celebration was a work of art in itself too. And it's just with that iconic image of them all doing that. Shearer, by the way, absolutely in the thick of it. He was the one squirting the water bottle. But just a perfect moment.
That the Ince comment there, Ollie, is really interesting, because there will be players on the side go, oh, hang on a minute, this isn't over. It's only, you know, it's only our second. We still got to protect the lead, etc., etc. Maybe that's the Roy Keane effect on Paul Ince through the Manchester United midfield coming through.
It was obviously, the goal was scored, and was it three or four players? I remember Sheringham and Shearer and McManaman being in there. And yeah, I imagine the rest of them were just sort of trotting back to the halfway line. And it wasn't this sort of huge, sort of the whole team orchestrated thing. It was sort of four or five players, but it was a very sort of clever and funny, and I mean, clearly not spontaneous, but it was a great send up of what had happened and sort of reowning the dentist chair. If England had got knocked out, and you know, the dentist chair would be remembered as in notoriety rather than this moment that triggered a funny celebration of a fondly remembered goal at a fondly remembered campaign, it would be very different, wouldn't it? My thought, just watching back that Gazza goal, and the flick is obviously magnificent. It's a, you know, beautifully weighted, and the shot is perfect technique. But what I think it probably underlines is, with Gazza, I think people who have probably only just seen a few highlights of him, maybe that goal, maybe, you know, the Cruyff turn against Holland in 1990 and various, you know, various dribbles and so on. But the thing about him was he was incredibly skillful, but he was also sort of really at his best. He was adrenaline fueled. And I remember a couple of goals he scored for Tottenham in their FA Cup run in 91, where it was just like incredible technique, but he was just piling forward and just, you could almost sort of sense the steam coming out of his nose. And he was like that with that goal. It was adrenaline. It was really aggressive to carry that out, that technique. It was also aggressively done. It wasn't just sort of balletic, artistic, brilliant. It was real powerful, aggressive, dynamic run.
Violent artistry is what it was. And he was elbows. He was powerful. He was big. He was powerful. I mean, I remember that so vividly from watching him at Newcastle. And by the way, he's the person that made me sort of look at football and look at football in a way that was poetic and beautiful. But it wasn't, you know, absolutely, it wasn't that sort of nimble. It wasn't the nimbleness of a gymnast. He was able to dribble the ball in a straight line through people. And that's because of how powerful he was. He was elbows, you know, he was sharp elbows, but, you know, still something absolutely sort of magical about it. But no, he was, you know, he had that physical ability to get through people, not around people, just, you know, but still stunning in its own way.
He talked there, George, about, you know, the difficulty in the build-up to the tournament for him and so on and so forth, and that release. But a bit like we talked about earlier, you know, England's tumultuous 6 years from 1993 to Euro 96, it's the same for Gascoigne as well, isn't it? I mean, what he went through in those 6 years, some of it self-inflicted, was a lot. I mean, that the release is not just the dentist chair and what happened 2 weeks before the tournament. There's more to it than that.
No, absolutely. And as you say, a lot of it self-inflicted, but sort of huge trauma in his life. And, you know, you sort of look back now and I think we all sort of asked the question about whether he was equipped to sort of deal with it. But you go back to 1990 and the kid crying on the pitch, who'd just done this sort of extraordinary stuff. So incredibly important, I think, to us as a footballing nation, because that was the moment when football really exploded. It was very, football became fashionable. He led that. It was all about him. And he makes, you know, that it makes me emotional sort of thinking about that, because I think the times in my life when I felt most English are 1990, the summer of 1990, and probably 1996, a sort of close second, which is what football can do, but it's also about the sort of moment, the historical moment. And I won't digress too much on that. He'd been through this sort of traumatic existence, and it has to be remembered, he was playing for Rangers at that point. So, you know, this game was personal for him, in a way that it probably, I mean, people were having their own little battles across the pitch. It was Shearer against Colin Hendry. You know, that was a sort of big, you know, that was a big deal because they were teammates at Blackburn. And we did think about football much more in those individual battle terms. But it was also, you know, it was kind of Gaza against Scotland because that's where he was playing at the time.
Is that, for you, Dan, the most iconic England goal ever? And I stress iconic rather than best, because I think if you, for it to be an iconic goal, it has to take into account who scored it, the setting, the opposition. There's a lot that goes into it. You know, Yarmolenko scored an unbelievable goal for Ukraine last night, but it's in a 3-2 defeat against the Dutch in their opening game of the tournament. That's going to be an iconic goal, I would imagine, in Ukrainian football history.
I mean, I think we all know by now that the Gary Neville cross was more iconic than the Gaza goal. But in terms of when I think of England and when I think of the international team, the first thing that comes into my mind is that Gaza goal. And it will be the same for people of my generation, people of other generations. I'd imagine 70-80%, I mean, people that are around, obviously, when England won the World Cup, will think of England winning the World Cup. But because I haven't seen any success, the thing I think of is that Gaza goal. And that was really what ignited England in Euro 96. That was what gave them liftoff, carried them into that magnificent Holland game and made the tournament what it was. And the fact that Gaza, like you say, did play for Rangers and there was all those battles, that was the big moment. I hadn't really seen much of Gaza because he wasn't part of the Premier League. So I'd never really seen him play. So this was my first exposure to him as well. And he just seemed magical because there was no one like him. So yeah, when I think of England, that is the moment that I think of.
Well, after that England-Scotland game, England went on to be glorious in beating the Dutch. They then had the penalty victory against Spain and then that crushing disappointment of the semi-final defeat against Germany and Gareth Southgate's penalty miss. The players, though, look back on Euro 96 with real pride at what they achieved. Here once again, Ince, Sheringham and Gascoigne on what it was like to be in the middle of it all.
Just when I walked, I just remember going out and doing the national anthem and just seeing all the fans there. And, you know, even on the coach journey out, you know, just going up towards Wembley, you have people hanging out the windows and people hanging out the pubs. And, you know, the longer we went into the tournament, the more people were hanging out the pubs and the cars were beeping and that. But that particular day, you know, it was just unreal. You know, and the Scottish fans were brilliant, looking up there and seeing all the tartan caps they had on. And it's everything you want to be involved in.
Yeah,
you know?
I just remember the whole just built up, next game, going into it, the whole nation getting behind us, the adrenaline buzzing through the camp and going into the next game and the next game.
When we played Holland, and when Terry Venables says, look, all you got to do is play them at their own game, and we did, you know, and I've looked at some of the highlights of that. Well, I watched the game and, you know, I think I worked hard for the lads and I think to beat them 4-1, and I remember David Platt coming on, and I gave him the ball, and he gave me the ball, and he went, go on, it's your game. And then when you've got, like, you know, you've got a stadium of 90,000 people, and you've got Gary Neville, Man United, you've got the other player playing for Chelsea, you've got the others for Liverpool. Obviously, when you've got 90,000 singing your name for the last few minutes, I actually went back to my hotel room and started crying my eyes out. I was just so, sorry, I'm nearly crying now. Yeah, I was so proud, you know, and obviously to beat them and you get a goal. Shearer got, Teddy got a couple of goals because obviously we used to score and the pressure was on him. So him to get a couple, you get your goal as well, you know, and to batter them at their own game, it was fantastic, you know. And then that's when I thought we're going to win this. I think we would have if it be Germany, you know.
I feel quite emotional listening to Gascoigne there. Ollie, do you know, I always, when I was growing up, I used to hear people hark back and talk about the 60s and how great the 60s were and how much fun they were. And I thought, really, why do you hark back to the past? And now I'm turning into one of those people because, honestly, Ollie, after the last 5 or 6 years, I just think, bloody hell, I miss the late 90s. I miss, like, you know, everything from about 95, 96. Well, the 90s as a whole, but particularly 96 seemed to set us just on an amazingly enjoyable few years. Maybe it was my age at the time. I don't know.
No, I'm sure part of it is age. But no, I mean, the 2018 World Cup was good, and England got to the semi final and so on. But that, you know, 90 and 96 were times when I think the whole country really kind of embraced what was happening in front of them, and it was these games that were like roller coaster rides. It wasn't like that sort of fairly tepid win over Tunisia and Panama and Sweden that England had at the last World Cup. It was games that the wins, they weren't necessarily tournaments full of great performances, but the highs were really high, and the lows in terms of the performance, I mean, England battled through those games. You know, the game against Spain in Euro 96 and the games against sort of Belgium and Cameroon in 1990, where they scrapped and rode their luck. But the 90s in terms of England, it felt very different to how it certainly felt in the 2010s when everything felt completely miserable.
It's that sense of human epic, isn't it? I mean, I think tournament football at its best is an epic because, of course, it lasts a month or whatever. And so you have all these stories that kind of come and go. But 96, it feels like it sort of had all the elements of that sort of epic thing. And, you know, in purely sporting sense and, you know, very mindful of what I'm saying, bearing in mind what we saw happen on the pitch the other day, but it has the sort of the sporting tragedy at the end of it. It has Germany again, it has the penalties again, but it has Stuart Pearce's redemption, you know, against Spain. They play Holland off the pitch and then have a really tough grind against Spain, but you see all that emotion coming out of Stuart Pearce's face when he converts that penalty. You've got the kind of whole Gaza redemption sort of song as well, and that's it. It took us to every single part of the emotional spectrum. I mean, it was disgruntlement at the start. It was tension, but it was joy, it was triumph, it was bittersweet of the near miss yet again, which of course is very much part of our psyche when it comes to tournaments. But it captured everything. It captured the mood of the nation. It was here, so there was that sense of scale to it as well. And football at its best, tournament football at its best, touches you in a way that no other kind of football can. It was just beautiful. It was this huge, huge, huge scale event.
Yeah, I feel the same. Like, I hark back to 96 and I look at it with these rose-tinted glasses of it just been the best time ever, because football has cheated me since then. Because in 96 was the last time Villa won anything. So in 94 and 96, Villa won the Coca-Cola Cup. So I thought, Villa will win things every few years. That's what happens. And they haven't won anything since 96. I was at Euro 96, watching Euro 96, thinking, England are brilliant. They're going to win it. And then from the moment they lost that penalty shootout, I've just been miserable ever since. Nothing good's really happened to any of my teams since then. So it kind of has wronged me a little bit. But I thought yesterday Sunday with England at Wembley again, I got the vibe of Euro 96 again in that win. I got the feel good. I felt like something special was happening. So I'm probably setting myself up for a fall. But Sunday was the closest I've kind of felt watching England again. But it's the most connected I've felt to an England team again, I think, this year. I think since 96, this is the most connected I've felt.
I think that's a great point. I mean, I think, in fact, Alan Shearer said that sort of in his introduction on the BBC coverage, that, not trying to say that this is football coming home again and all that kind of stuff. But we have that sense that if football represents anything, it is that sense of home. It's people, it's other people, basically, is what it is. And suddenly we have this, with the world just bursting to sort of be released from what we've all kind of gone through over the last 16 months. Or is that just feeling of just wanting to let go and wanting to be part of something and, needing to kind of feel something, anything again. And I agree with Dan, seeing and kind of more importantly, probably hearing Wembley like that was just very, 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 very special. And, that's exactly what 96 was. It was that sort of just huge explosion of sort of noise and sound and feeling and togetherness. And there was some brilliant football in it, but iconic moments absolutely wherever you looked.
Connection's the key. Connection's the key, isn't it, Ollie? And that's what both Dan and George have said there. And connection can come in all sorts of forms. It can come and connect with that Euro 96 team because we were probably behaving in a similar way to they were when they go back to that dentist chair and the alcohol, and you relate to the flawed human being of wanting to get pissed sometimes and so on and so forth. Equally now, I look at this England team and I can connect with them because they're just decent. They're just decent individuals. Calvin Phillips in a post-match interview with us yesterday, just, he kept saying thank you. It's like, no, you don't have to thank us for praising you. Just tell us how you did it. And they just seem really, really nice blokes.
When we emphasise that point and how sort of relatable this England team and England squad is, I don't think that's ever, if I look back to, David Beckham and Steven Gerrard and Frank Lampard and people like that, they were entirely relatable and decent people as well. But there was always this feeling watching that England team that there were sort of, collectively, they weren't as relatable collectively, I don't think. And there was also the feeling that, the club careers were all consuming, and some of them have talked about that and how they never really sort of got it together as a team or often didn't get it together as a team with England at tournaments. And that, it's those moments when an England, a group of really good individuals comes together as a national team at a tournament, which England did in 90, they did in 96. I think they did with a lesser group of players in 2018. And I think this group of players looks like, it's very relatable. They have a very sort of strong sense of what playing for England means and what they're required to do on the pitch. I think Gareth Southgate has been very good at that. But I think they're relatable. And I think they're relatable not just to sort of football fans like us and football media like us, but I think it's a group of players that perhaps your average sort of very casual football fan, or maybe somebody who isn't, you know, somebody who isn't into football, they could end up getting on the bandwagon with this team the way they perhaps did in 96 and did in 1990. And that's one thing I remember in those two World Cups, where you'd suddenly get people who had no interest in football suddenly sounding like they knew who the England team were. And sometimes as football obsessives, we get really very defensive about our sport and people jumping on the bandwagon and getting into it. But you know what England are doing well when people who have no interest in football suddenly get on the bandwagon. That was certainly the case in Euro 96.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This is The England Show from The Athletic. Keep up to date with all of our Euro 2020 podcasts and writing by following us at The Athletic UK.
The Alan Shearer Euro 96 article is on The Athletic now, and you can get it for £1 a month, the whole of the site, for 6 months, if you go to theathletic.com/England pod. So theathletic.com/England pod, you get all The Athletic articles, including Shearer's Euro 96 one, for £1 a month for 6 months. Quick one from all of you on, actually, England against Scotland this time around on Friday. Do you see it, George, first of all, as being as tight as it was 25 years ago?
I think partly that because the format's changed, and I hate this new format where effectively, you know, three teams can qualify from a group. So I think it loses its jeopardy. I mean, obviously England have started very well, which is makes a massive change, because they certainly didn't do that in 96. They didn't do it in 1990 either. So they've taken a lot of pressure off themselves. I still think there will be that sense of occasion and pressure simply because of who they're playing. But it's a slightly, you know, I think there's a slightly sort of different backdrop to it. I mean, I hope there is a bit of that ferocity, because I miss that. You know, I do miss that about football, and that sort of sense of having to win your personal battle first. I would like to see a bit of that. I would like a bit of rawness to the occasion. And I hope, you know, in a respectful and sort of fun way, I hope there's a bit of that. I hope there's a bit of that.
Ollie?
We're recording this before Scotland play Czech Republic on Monday. Man for man, you would say England are stronger in most positions. I think, you know, maybe, yeah, probably not left back, and probably not one of, you know, maybe one other, I would say, and that isn't arrogance. I think that's just in terms of the standard and status that those players are playing at. But they're very good players. They're very good players. And Scotland have generally had a knack over the last few years of being sort of equal or greater than some of their parts again. And that's what England have generally not been at tournaments. They're going to have to be sort of equal or greater than some of their parts if they're going to do something. I think the win over Croatia was quite encouraging in that regard. I wouldn't go crazy about the performance, but it was a really positive start.
Dan, you're going to be in charge of the England show tomorrow as we continue our build-up to the game on Friday. So how do you see it at this stage? Because obviously, as Ollie says, this is before Scotland have played Czech Republic. tomorrow when you're hosting. It'll be after that. So maybe your opinion will change on tomorrow's pod.
I think obviously it's a really, really big game. I think it'll actually in a lot of ways be tougher for England than the opening game against Croatia. I know it's kind of easy to say that now after the game's taken place, but I would have said that probably beforehand, because I think for all the good things that we've just levelled at England, I think a lot of that can be levelled at the Scotland camp as well now. I think they're in as good a place as they've been for a number of years. And I just think with the fact it's been so long since they qualified for a major tournament, I think they are going to be massively, massively up for it. And I think there will be some spice. I think it'll be a really entertaining game. I think there will be that need, or like a derby game in the Premier League or in Scotland. I think it's going to be intense, and I'm really looking forward to it, but I think it'll be tight.
Great stuff, everybody. George, Ollie, thank you. Dan, thank you as well. Dan in charge then tomorrow as we continue our build-up to England against Scotland, which is on Friday. Thanks for listening.
The Athletic.